This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
U.S. troops scramble to airlift Americans and Afghans from Kabul. Canadian critics say their country should have started evacuations sooner.
I don't doubt for a minute that everybody is trying incredibly hard at this moment to do the right thing. But we needed to do the right thing 3 months ago.
I'm Carol Hills. Today, the latest on Afghanistan and a new prime minister takes office in Malaysia as COVID grips the country.
It's bad. More than 20,000 cases per day.
And an icon of both the Jazz Age and the French Resistance gets high honors in France. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The U.S. military says it's carried out its biggest day of airlifts out of Kabul since the Taliban retook the capital of Afghanistan a week ago. 16,000 people got out on U.S. military flights in the last 24 hours, but many of those who are still stuck at the Kabul airport have been waiting without food, water, or shade. Department of Defense spokesman John Kirby said today that the Pentagon is mindful of these reports.
It's not lost on us. There's a lot of people. And they are desperate.
The Pentagon says planes being used for evacuation flights are dropping off food, water, and other supplies to the airport when they touch down.
We're doing the best we can under extraordinary circumstances. And believe me, the pain and the suffering, the fear, the anxiety, all of that, none of it is lost on us or our troops.
Outside the airport, chaos continues. 7 people were killed yesterday in a stampede of people pushing to enter the airport. At least one other person died after gunfire broke out at an airport entrance this morning, according to German officials. Many of the people trying to get out of Afghanistan are locals who worked with troops from the U.S. or other countries. One of those countries is Canada. It had forces in Afghanistan for 13 years until 2014. Those forces were supported by thousands of Afghan staff. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said last week that if the Taliban continue to restrict access to the Kabul airport, it will limit the number of Afghans Canada can evacuate.
We will get some, certainly. But to get many people out, as many as we'd want, is going to be almost impossible in the coming weeks.
Trudeau's government has been criticized for not evacuating people who worked for the Canadian government and their families earlier. Reporter Emma Jacobs has our story.
Every night in Ottawa, Tanya has been spending hours on calls and emails to anyone who might be able to help get her father and siblings out of Afghanistan. She asked us not to use her last name for their safety. When we first spoke on Thursday, she said she hadn't slept for 72 hours. Early the next morning, she finally fell asleep.
When I woke up, it was around 5 in the morning, and I just woke up in a panic. And I woke up and I called my father right away.
Tanya, a naturalized Canadian citizen, had been trying to get her family to Canada or the U.S. for years. The past few weeks, she's focused on evacuating her father, whom she says worked as a subcontractor repairing equipment for the Canadian and American militaries, making him a target now.
He's not answering, so I panicked. I called my brother and said, is everything okay? Are you guys okay? And they said, yes, we were attacked yesterday. And that just shattered me, basically.
Her brother told her armed men came to the house, but they escaped by climbing over a wall and have gone into hiding. Tanya sent her family's documents to the Canadian government 3 weeks ago after the government announced that Afghans looking to be evacuated should submit their information via email.
I sent my dad's ID cards and everything. Unfortunately, I have not heard back.
Late last week, Canadian Immigration Minister Marco Mendicino said evacuations were accelerating and Canada would waive requirements like COVID tests and passports. The day the Taliban entered Kabul, form emails were still encouraging Afghans to apply for passports. Mendicino said on CTV television yesterday that Canada had flown out 1,100 people, though some are reportedly bound for other allied countries. Officials have said they want to evacuate around 6,000 Afghans to Canada.
The situation on the ground is volatile, it's precarious, and so we're staying in constant contact with all the people we're trying to help.
An agency spokesperson, Remy Lariviere, said in an email that he could not disclose operational details, but wrote, quote, "We recognize the urgency of the situation and we will continue to work as quickly as possible." Loose networks of individuals and veterans have also mobilized to help. Andrew Rusk's sister-in-law was the first Canadian military woman to be killed in combat in Afghanistan. In July, he co-founded a group called Not Left Behind, focused on getting Afghans out.
I don't doubt for a minute that everybody is trying incredibly hard at this moment to do the right thing. But we needed to do the right thing 3 months ago, 4 months ago. And because of our delays, because of the paperwork, because of the bureaucracy, instead of getting people on planes, we've had Afghans that supported us hiding for their lives as they've been hunted by the Taliban.
Those approved for flights receive messages from the Canadian government to make their way to the airport in Kabul, which for many means crossing through Taliban checkpoints and crowds outside the gates. For some, the flights are just too late, says Rusk.
Last weekend, I received news from one of the veterans working on this that three cooks that worked with him in Kandahar were killed. A couple of weeks before, we heard that the wife of an interpreter was killed.
Canada has pledged to resettle 20,000 Afghans, including those being evacuated now. The rest will be people who get out of Afghanistan on their own. Maureen Silkoff is a past president of the Canadian Association of Refugee Lawyers. She says immigration officials should use flexible options at their disposal to get as many people on evacuation flights as possible and to expedite the process for those in other countries. She notes Canada waived some paperwork requirements during a past push to resettle 25,000 Syrian refugees.
Hopefully the situation with Afghan refugee resettlement will take those practices into account and, you know, we can see efficient measures put in place to really help people come to Canada and, you know, start new lives here.
Canada has a private sponsorship program which lets groups of Canadians support individual refugees' resettlement. Strong support for the program helped Canada eventually admit 39,000 Syrians in just under a year. Silkoff says she's encouraged to see lots of public interest in sponsoring refugees again. She hopes the number of Afghans admitted to Canada will also be expanded. For The World, I'm Emma Jacobs in Montreal.
In Russia, the Kremlin is continuing to crack down on independent media. One of the tools it uses to harass and in some cases silence independent voices is to brand them as foreign agents. The latest outlet in Russia to be given that label is TV Rain, Russia's most popular independent TV news network. Mikhail Fishman is an anchor with TV Rain. Mikhail, what does this foreign agent status mean?
It means the following. Every program, like my program, for example, my show, every news item that TV Rain generates on its website or on any social network, it has to be annotated with a message that this stuff was created by a foreign agent.
How does the Russian government define being a foreign agent? Like, why has it seen fit to say TV Rain is a foreign agent?
It claims that foreign agent media has foreign financing, but it treats this concept very broadly. It's totally political. It has very shallow legal basis behind it.
Mikhail, what about you? How does this label affect you personally as somebody who is a host on TV Rain?
It affects me because every show from now on, which I do with TV Rain, must be annotated with this message. I see myself as one of many, though fewer, with everyday independent voices in Russia, and I see it as intimidation and basically is directed at every independent voice in Russia. So basically, we are heading to a situation when in very short time, there will be no independent media in Russia whatsoever.
Give us a sense of the role TV Rain has played as an independent news outlet. Where does it sit in the Russian media landscape?
It's one of the most or even most influential independent media outlet in Russia because of its very large viewership, which it has on YouTube. We're talking about tens of millions of views on a daily basis.
What is behind this current anti-media campaign? What's going on?
Of course, it started not yesterday and not even 2 months ago. It started 20 years ago when Vladimir Putin came to power. For these 20 years, Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin execute crackdown on media. They started with television, then they moved to newspapers, then they moved to cable networks. They basically harassed the industry for years.
But what's going on right now? Is it the upcoming parliamentary elections in September that have prompted this crackdown in your mind?
It's many things. It's Putin who approved new constitution, which has new rule, of which is that he will stay in power forever. And the economic situation, which is not in his favor. And he has parliamentary elections in a month. And the popularity of his ruling party is at its lowest for decades, probably already. His own approval rating, while it's still high, is much lower than it was 4 years ago. So he finds himself in a very different situation, and that's why he has to crack down on every independent voice.
Give us a sense of the feeling among independent journalists who you've been talking to. How are people dealing with this current crackdown?
First of all, it's disgusting because it's very humiliating. And again, on a personal level, because TV Rain was labeled as foreign agent, as a media, as an entity. But what government also does, they cast as foreign agent specific journalists individually. This is something that you cannot unlabel yourself from, and you have to live with it. And it really turns you into an outcast. You also have to report to the government about your finances on a regular basis, and it not only technically complicates your life, but it really makes you enemy of the state.
I've read that some Russian journalists who've been labeled foreign agents are actually kind of making jokes about it in their newscasts and presentations. Here I am, a foreign agent going about my business. I mean, is there some role for dark humor that's happened with this crackdown?
Yes, because we're all trying to keep up to our optimism. I mean, TV Rain was labeled as foreign agent 1 hour before my show should have been starting last Friday. And basically, we turned it into a live commentary about what just happened. And of course, we also joked about it. And we, as independent journalists, want to keep up to our spirits, to stay strong. And it's about not letting the government know how you feel, you know, not letting the government take you down on this emotional level.
Is this media crackdown, is it affecting ordinary Russians, or is it a conversation and something that's really taking place among the independent media journalists?
It does affect Russians because they shut down news outlets. That means less independent news. Because these media, they generated news which were circulating across the internet. So it affects Russians in a way that they have less information about what's going on in Russia.
Mikhail, have the last couple of months made you consider moving and leaving Russia?
Well, now I understand, of course. I clearly see it, and I know that independent journalism is a dangerous field. It's not a metaphor anymore. It's real. Before, like a few months ago, a year ago, 2 years ago, I wouldn't even talk about that. Now, I can't exclude anything, and I think that every option has to be open from now on.
Mikhail Fishman is an independent journalist and an anchor with TV Rain, talking with us about the current pressures on independent journalism in Russia. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, pandemic lockdowns are not sitting well with people across Southeast Asia and Oceania. We head to Malaysia, New Zealand, and Australia just ahead. You're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Vice President Kamala Harris is in Southeast Asia this week. Harris started the trip in Singapore, where she met with Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong. He presented Kamala Harris with a species of orchid named after the vice president herself.
Oh, it's beautiful, and I'm honored to receive it.
But the trip has not been all flowers and sunshine. The point was to reassure U.S. allies in Southeast Asia that America is back and will be committed to that part of the world. But that task became more difficult after the Taliban takeover just a few days ago. Reporters asked questions along those lines during today's joint news conference with Harris and the Singaporean Prime Minister.
Does the fall of Afghanistan 20 years after the U.S. started military operations there, does that change your calculus on how you can rely on America as a partner in this region, both militarily and economically?
Lee was diplomatic with his answer, saying that what matters now is how the U.S. repositions itself in the region. Harris plans to travel to Vietnam on Tuesday, which is bound to raise a few eyebrows, given that the situation at the Kabul airport is being compared to America's frantic exit from Saigon in 1975. This state visit is the culmination of months of American outreach to the Asia Pacific, and it's very much about China's rising influence. One place Harris will not be visiting on this trip is Malaysia. A new prime minister there was sworn in on Saturday, less than a week after his predecessor resigned. Ismail Sabri Yaakob takes office just as the country is experiencing its worst spike in COVID-19 cases ever, and public anger continues to grow over mismanagement of the pandemic. For more on this, we turn to reporter Ashley Westerman. Welcome, Ashley.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, who is this new prime minister?
So Ismail Sabri Yaakob is a veteran politician in Malaysia. He served in several cabinet positions throughout his career. And until this weekend, he was the defense minister and deputy prime minister. Now, Carol, his swearing in is not just important because he's taking the helm during a health crisis, but it's also important because Ismail is a member of the United Malays National Organization, or UMNO, which is the main party in a coalition that governed Malaysia since its independence from the British in 1957 until 2018. And now in 2018 was when the opposition unseated UMNO because the party became embroiled in this multi-billion dollar worldwide graft scandal known as 1MDB. But things have been very rocky since, and Ismail is Malaysia's third prime minister since that historic turnover in government.
So what happened last week?
So last Monday, Ismail's predecessor, Prime Minister Mujahidin Yassin, and his entire cabinet stepped down after a very tumultuous 17 months in office. Mujahidin came into office with a razor-thin majority to begin with. Then as the pandemic began to take hold, he and his government were heavily criticized for their management of it. And eventually, political infighting lost him the majority in parliament. So Malaysia's King Al-Sultan Abdullah, the constitutional monarch, ruled out elections because of the pandemic and decided he would appoint a prime minister from a short list provided by members of parliament. And this is a constitutional power that he has. Ismail ended up receiving a slim majority of votes from these MPs. And because Ismail had that support, the king appointed him prime minister. However, analysts say that because he was elected by such a slim majority, Malaysia's political woes aren't necessarily over.
What's been the reaction to all this?
Somber and underwhelming, actually. That's what Yi Sun Oh, a political analyst in the capital Kuala Lumpur, told me. He's with Pacific Research Center Malaysia and the Singapore Institute of International Affairs. He says Malaysians see UMNO coming back into power as more of just the same, a return to a status quo of corruption, collusion, and abuse of power that the party was previously known for. Plus,
the fact that the new prime minister is not a particularly awe-inspiring politician. Granted, he has a very long political record, but they were not a stellar one in terms of policy formulation as well as execution and performance.
Oh says Ismail is actually not expected to diverge much from the way the previous government was handling the pandemic or trying to restart the economy. And those are his two most pressing issues.
So what is the COVID situation in Malaysia?
It's bad. The country has one of the worst case counts in Southeast Asia right now, and that's after having escaped the worst of the pandemic last year. Malaysia is now having its biggest COVID surge ever. Cases have been steadily growing since the end of March and then skyrocketed at the beginning of June. Earlier this month, Malaysia was recording more than 20,000 cases per day, and they continue to hover around that amount. And last week, they hit over 1.5 million cumulative cases, and deaths are above 13,000. The Delta variant is definitely making things worse, and the country keeps flipping in and out of lockdowns. And this waffling is what's making a lot of the public really angry, because it's not curbing infection rates, and thousands have lost their livelihoods. But all this bad news is actually despite Malaysia having one of the fastest vaccination rates in the world. Over 40% of the population of nearly 32 million people are fully vaccinated. And the new prime minister has already said that the government will purchase an additional 6 million vaccines, and those are expected to arrive next month.
We've been speaking to reporter Ashley Westerman. Ashley, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Last week, New Zealand announced one case of COVID-19. It was the first community-transmitted case since February. The government's reaction was drastic and swift. It locked down the country and closed the borders. At a press conference, Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said New Zealand is aiming for total elimination of the virus.
Going hard and early has worked for us before. While we know that Delta is a more dangerous enemy to combat, the same actions that overcame the virus last year can be applied to beat it again.
Cases are still going up, though. The New Zealand cluster has grown to 107 cases, and Ardern has extended the lockdown and said she is sticking to the original approach.
For now, the elimination strategy is the right thing for New Zealand.
But it seems it's no longer the right thing for New Zealand's neighbour, Australia. At a press briefing on Monday, Prime Minister Scott Morrison hinted that his country was no longer counting on total elimination of the virus.
We must adjust our mindset. We will live with this virus as we live with other infectious diseases.
Australia has a zero-tolerance policy like New Zealand's, and its largest cities have been in strict lockdown. But the Delta variant is raging. It's worse in Australia than it is in New Zealand. Sydney reported upwards of 800 positive cases in the past 24 hours, and Australians are getting frustrated. Thousands of people took to the streets over the weekend in Sydney and Melbourne to protest the long lockdowns. Morrison urged his citizens to hang in there.
It is always darkest before the dawn. And I think these lockdowns are a demonstration of that. But the dawn is not far away.
Morrison said he would ease restrictions once the vaccination rate reaches 70 to 80%. At the current rate, that won't happen until December. Looks like the dawn is still a ways away. Across the globe, the world has been working to make sense of the coronavirus pandemic together with Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Explore our ongoing series of online conversations about the coronavirus, efforts to control it, and its effect on our lives. Those videos are at theworld.org, along with all of our reporting on the pandemic. This is The World. You've heard that the Earth's ice is melting. For sea ice in the Arctic, that means more of the ocean's heat escapes into the air.
We see this looking like smoke coming up, basically, because the ocean water is warmer than the atmosphere.
Head with us to a lab in the far north to see some of that melting ice and learn why it matters. Coming up here on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. When the Taliban took control of Afghanistan last weekend, it also took over a lot of military hardware and weapons. Much of it had been provided by the U.S. Here's Pentagon spokesperson John Kirby today.
I don't have an exact inventory of what equipment that the Afghans had at their disposal that now might be at risk.
At risk of being used by the Taliban. For perspective on the problem, we turn to Jody Vittori, a retired U.S. Air Force officer who served in Afghanistan. She leads Georgetown's Global Politics and Security Program.
We're not 100% certain how much equipment the Taliban have acquired because we haven't always taken terrific accountability of what equipment went where at what times, particularly when it came to small arms. We have a better idea with aircraft.
And what is the situation with the aircraft that was left over?
A number of American aircraft flew to Uzbekistan, And so did the, of course, the pilots and the air crew associated with them. But the Taliban have captured some American-made and other aircraft. We know that because they've showed pictures of them. Some of those aircraft were not operational at the time, however, and we do have reports that the Taliban are looking for aircraft pilots and aircraft maintainers that might be able to get that back into the air.
Is there a possible scenario where the Taliban could coerce U.S.-trained pilots still in Afghanistan to fly the remaining aircraft?
Absolutely. I could see plenty of possibilities of being able to coerce pilots, unfortunately, not only threatening pilots with their own lives, but the lives of their families. We see continuing reports of, you know, the Taliban, for example, with blacklists, saying that if certain people don't turn themselves into the Taliban, they will punish the families. So they're certainly more than willing to do that. I can imagine they would be willing to do similar with pilots as well. And, you know, if you're the pilot and your family members are being threatened, that's a hard thing to turn down.
But bottom line, as somebody who served in the Air Force, is your sense that the Taliban don't instantly have an air force of their own? They need either other people or parts to make it work?
Yes, they're going to need support of those former helicopter pilots and so forth that were serving with the Afghan National Defense and Security Forces. But, you know, also do remember the Taliban took over Afghanistan without an air force. Air support's a nice to have for them, but it's not the need to have it was for the Afghan National Defense and Security Forces.
Do you know why Afghanistan's aircraft were not destroyed when the Taliban took control of the capital?
I presume just because it happened so incredibly quickly. There just wasn't time to destroy all of those aircraft. It does take time to do that with the explosives and so forth. Hopefully there weren't any deals made that involved those aircraft. We don't really know what completely went on at this point with the various Afghan senior leadership, individual generals acting on their own initiative when it came to negotiating with the Taliban.
What about other hardware that the Taliban may now have? Howitzer artillery, machine guns and rifles, night vision goggles. How easy will it be for the Taliban to get these into the field and operational?
These should be relatively easy to get into the field and operational. You know, seen lots of pictures of them with U.S. small arms, for example, M4s, M16s already fighting. They've had long experience of using captured U.S. Western gear. So they should be capable of putting those into fight fairly quickly.
It's interesting. There have already been protests in Afghanistan, and the Taliban have been using violence to quell them. Over the weekend, the Taliban said hundreds of its fighters were heading to the Panjshir Valley, where there's strong resistance. Do you think that all these captured weapons will change the Taliban's approach to stifling dissent?
I don't think it will change the Taliban's approach to stifling dissent, because the Taliban have often been very willing to use violence to stifle dissent their entire reign since they first came into being since 1994. What it does do is it gives them additional capabilities, just an overwhelming amount of potential weaponry that they can use to stifle that dissent, whether it's in, you know, individual small villages, whether it's in cities, or whether it's taking small arms and larger artillery pieces and so forth, as much as they can, given road networks and so forth, up to places like the Panjshir Valley.
Jody Vittori is co-chair of the Global Politics and Security Program at Georgetown University. She was telling us about the weapons that the Taliban have acquired from the Afghan military. Thanks so much, Jody.
Thank you very much, Carol.
Sea ice coverage in the Arctic last month was the lowest ever recorded in July. And that big UN climate report that came out earlier this month found that the last decade was more ice-free than any other period in the past 1,000 years. Reporter Brett Simpson visited the Norwegian Polar Institute above the Arctic Circle to see some of that ice and to talk to a scientist who makes some of those ice measurements to find out what these changes mean.
Along the Arctic Ocean in the city of Tromsø, Norway, there's a massive white building designed to look like an iceberg falling into the water. Inside, one of the scientists responsible for those sea ice measurements has been hard at work.
I'm Sebastian Gerland. I'm a scientist for sea ice and climate at the Norwegian Polar Institute.
For decades, Gerland has led an annual Arctic expedition to collect samples of sea ice. Over the years, he says the ice is getting younger. That means more of the Arctic sea ice is melting away completely each summer. And that's a bad thing, because sea ice plays a crucial role in cooling down the planet.
It reflects a lot of the solar radiation that's coming in. So if there is no ice, there's more warming of the surface.
Warm water circulating up from the equator typically cools down underneath sea ice cover. But when it's exposed, that water stays warm and heats up the atmosphere too. Downstairs in his lab, Garland tells me that when he's on an expedition, he can actually see the heat escaping through cracks in the ice.
We see this looking like smoke coming up, basically, because the ocean water is warmer than the atmosphere.
But most changes in the ice aren't so obvious to the naked eye. So Garland and his team drill out ice cores and bring them back to the lab.
We go to the ice storage.
To a freezer vault deep underground.
So this is the outer door, and now comes the inner door.
It is cold in here.
The Sub-Zero freezer has stacks of styrofoam boxes.
So here are ice samples.
The drill they use, he says, is about a meter long.
The drill is about a meter long, so we get pieces around a meter. Of course, if the ice is that thick.
Increasingly, it's not that thick.
The ice is, I can open another one.
The next cylinder of ice Garland shows me is only about half the length of the box. Garland says that shorter cores are becoming more common as the ice thins.
Maybe we first go out of the room so we don't get too cold.
My fingers are about to fall off.
Back in the relative warmth of his lab, Garland tells me why he went to all the trouble of drilling these samples. When he slices into these ice cores and looks at them under a microscope, he can read the story of a changing Arctic.
Because once the ice starts to melt, it becomes porous. We can see these pores and holes, a bit like a Swiss cheese.
Garland's research finds that Swiss cheese ice means it can melt faster, warming up the ocean and atmosphere and changing weather conditions.
If you have a large area that is not ice-covered but used to be ice-covered, that's making a change also to the processes that generate the different weathers.
Different weather that other people are noticing too.
I never experienced that. So bad sea condition.
That's Trond Erald, an indigenous Sami fisherman. He says that this summer, for the first time, heavy storms kept him off the sea for an entire month.
Strong wind in the summer, you know, not like used to. Very dangerous winds also.
Erald told me that heavy rains and extreme temperature fluctuations have all made it harder to fish. And he says it's not just this year either.
10 to 5 years, it's been changing slowly. Slowly. In the last 3 or 4 years, it's getting more.
Scientist Sebastian Garland and his colleagues are learning more and more about the ripple effects of sea ice melting. Right now, they're studying how it impacts salinity and ice flow. But Erald is less forward-looking. He comes from a long line of salmon fishers that he fears may end with him.
I think I'm the fourth generation, and probably the last. I don't see much hope for in the next future.
He says that future generations will have to find new ways to make a living in the far north. For The World, I'm Brett Simpson, Northern Norway.
Our story was reported with support from the Pulitzer Center. The Biden administration is working to revamp how it responds to people seeking asylum in the United States to speed up the asylum application process. But speed doesn't necessarily mean asylum seekers will get the answer they want to their asylum applications. To talk about all of this, Doris Meissner joins me now. She led the former U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service during the Clinton administration and today is with the Migration Policy Institute. Doris, the Biden administration has talked about possibly fast-tracking asylum cases and changing where and how they're adjudicated. How would that work? What are they proposing?
I wouldn't call it fast-tracking as much as streamlining the process in a way that makes it possible for these asylum decisions actually to get made. I mean, the way that cases that arise at the U.S.-Mexico border are handled now is that they go through what's called a credible fear screening at the U.S.-Mexico border. That's a screening that is done by asylum officers who are highly trained, work in the Department of Homeland Security and something called United States Citizenship and Immigration Services. They screen for whether there is a quote-unquote significant possibility that the person could be eligible for asylum. But then the current system refers those cases to immigration judges in the immigration court system, which is part of the Department of Justice. And that court system is so backlogged presently that it takes years, an average of 4 or 5 years, for the case actually to be heard. That's a failing system.
How does the Biden administration want to change that?
So the Biden administration wants to keep those cases with the Department of Homeland Security, with these asylum officers and the asylum structure. And those asylum officers would hear the cases in several months rather than years. And then if the cases are approved, then those applicants would be able to start their new lives. They'd be on their way. For those cases that are not approved, if people wanted to appeal them, they could then go before an immigration judge.
So, but what are the practical implications of having asylum officers decide these cases as opposed to immigration courts?
Well, the practical implications are that asylum officers are well-trained. They do this work for what's called the affirmative asylum system. They are doing cases like this that arise within the United States all the time. They have been doing so for, 25 years. The setting is private. It's not a courtroom. It's a private interview. It is an interview that is intended to elicit the information in the most informed way possible for the claimant. It's non-adversarial. The court system that presently exists is an adversarial proceeding. It has government attorneys that are acting as prosecutors. It has a judge. That can be a very intimidating setting for an asylum applicant.
There are some critics to Biden's plan, and they say that fast-tracking these cases would not give asylum seekers enough time to prepare their cases. Do you agree?
I don't agree. It is not fast-tracking from the standpoint of just doing it at the border and, turning people back. It is screening at the border, and then it is allowing people to go to a destination that they're intending to go to inside the country, but then hearing their case in a few months. That should be sufficient time to prepare the case. It is an effort to do a reset with what is now a situation at the border of a system that is failing and also a system that can be misused by people who may not have strong claims. It is an effort to try to make it possible for those who are eligible for asylum to get that eligibility determined, but to create a balance between timeliness in decision-making and a fair decision-making process that we don't have now.
That's Doris Meissner talking about possible changes to the U.S. asylum system. She's with the Migration Policy Institute, a nonpartisan research group. Doris, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
In Lebanon, the situation continues to get worse. A fuel shortage has the country on the verge of crisis, and Lebanon's caretaker government appears absent. Meanwhile, Lebanese militant group Hezbollah says it has secured fuel via Iran. But the U.S. says it will also work to get fuel for the country. With us to discuss how this might work and what this means is Karim Chahayeb. He's a freelance journalist based in Beirut, where he joins us from. Karim, how bad has the fuel crisis gotten in Lebanon?
It's simply awful. We have seen it worsen throughout the year, but now we're at a point where hospitals are under last drops of diesel fuel to power their machines. State electricity is virtually no longer existent, and you can go to gas stations now filled with cars waiting in line for 4 or 5 hours at a time. The army is there, the security forces are there to stop people from fighting. So it is quite a disaster.
What has caused this fuel crisis?
So, the fuel crisis is sort of a microcosm of Lebanon's economic crisis. The central bank subsidizes fuel imports. That allows licensed importers to bring in fuel at a pretty affordable cost. The problem with the subsidies program is that it's extremely expensive. And now with Lebanon, with its economic crisis, it's realizing that it's actually running out of money. Now, here's the problem. There's complete policy in action. Parliament isn't doing much. The caretaker cabinet is not doing any much. Now we're at a point, we're at a crossroads where we can't afford to keep these subsidies. But if we lift them, it's going to be, massive hyperinflation for fuel prices. So the central bank is not, giving the importers lines of credit. So you have ships, cargo ships of fuel at the port, but the central bank isn't giving money to the importers to bring that oil in.
Now, let's go to Hezbollah. They're looking to get fuel from Iran. What are the motivations there?
Yeah, it's a very interesting development, and I think it's part of a wider sort of campaign or political effort from Hezbollah. So since the crisis began, the international community has told Lebanon that without structural reforms, economic and accountability reforms, they're not going to give the country life-saving loans and aid to restructure the economy. And the international community, whether it's the World Bank, the United States, the EU, they've been propping up Lebanon for a very long time. But the Lebanese government is not willing to do these kinds of reforms. In comes Hezbollah, and they say, well, look, if they don't want to help us and they're giving us a hard time while our situation crumbles, why don't we look eastward? He's saying we could do development deals with China. Iran would like to help us too, and they're happy to negotiate an affordable price for us.
But is the move by Hezbollah, is it prompting the Lebanese government to get its act together and present a plan?
Well, I've spoken with some MPs and lawmakers. A lot of them are not interested in commenting on the matter. I think they're really waiting to kind of see whether this alternative deal, which the United States is backing, will go through. And it's a deal that involves Egypt, Jordan, and the World Bank.
Tell us more about that. What's the U.S. proposing?
So we're talking about we would be bringing in natural gas fuel through Egypt via Jordan and then Lebanon through Syria and with World Bank funding. The United States is apparently discussing matters with the World Bank right now. Of course, the weird elephant in the room is the CSAR Act sanctions on Syria, which the U.S. relatively recently brought in. So this is something which, I mean, even the U.S. ambassador said is a tricky matter, but they're trying to figure it out. And the idea is this would be a much more official way of doing it without going through a channel like Hezbollah, which the United States sanctions and recognizes as a terrorist organization.
Seems like every couple of weeks we're going back to Lebanon for a story about how nothing's moving forward. From your perspective covering this story, what is it going to take to get real movement?
1 year ago when the Beirut port exploded and flattened the capital, and I remember walking around the neighborhoods and I thought, okay, this is it. This has to be it. Because things keep getting worse and worse. I think a big step forward right now is that if a government is formed, full-fledged government, because at least to actually have them get, you know, talks started again with the IMF, to actually pass some, you know, important laws and decisions to stop the hemorrhaging. Recovering from this economic crisis is going to take a very long time.
Karim Chahayeb is a freelance journalist based in Beirut. Thanks so much, Karim.
Thank you for having me.
Josephine Baker was an American-born singer, dancer, and performer who made her home in France. She became a symbol of the jazz age and roaring 20s and one of her adopted country's greatest music hall stars. Now she will be given one of France's greatest honors. Her remains will be moved to the Pantheon Mausoleum in Paris, joining other French icons like Victor Hugo, Marie Curie, and Jean-Jacques Rousseau. That's after nearly 40,000 people signed a petition calling for the honor. Benetta Jules Rosette is author of the book Josephine Baker in Art and Life and joins us now. Welcome, Benetta.
Thank you, Carol.
It's a remarkable story. Josephine Baker was born in St. Louis, and she moved to France in the 1920s when she was a young woman. What kept her in France? She stayed there to the end of her life.
Yeah, what kept her in France is that France received her well and gave her a number of possibilities for performance. So she started in the music hall. She made 4 feature films. So to answer your question really briefly, France gave her the opportunity, as it did for many African Americans between the 1930s all the way through, I would say, even the 1970s. It gave these people an opportunity to make careers that were not possible in a segregated United States.
What was she like as a performer?
Josephine got her start in vaudeville theater. She even performed in blackface a couple of times, both during her early youth and even in France. She started as a comedic dancer. She performed her famous savage dance, Danse Sauvage, which later became the banana dance. It's a story of a young sort of savage woman running around in the wilds, in the tropics, dancing and who's chased by a colonial hunter.
Do we know about Josephine Baker's own opinion of how she presented these kind of racial stereotypes and tropes?
Very quickly, and Josephine was really rapid on picking up these things. She began to learn about the implications of these stereotypes. By 1930, she had a real handle on this. She saw these stereotypes as really a way of poking fun at the larger dominant society. And in 1932, she issued a song called If I Were White, which was a critique of Mistinguette, the dominant music hall performer. And here she performed in whiteface with a blonde wig. So she was obviously really poking fun at these stereotypes and turning them in reverse.
We're talking with Bonetta Jules Rosette, who studied the life of performer Josephine Baker. Bonetta, I know you have a very personal connection to Josephine Baker and her famous speech at the March on Washington in 1963. Tell us about that.
Yeah. I was only 14 years old at that time. I was at the march, and that was the first time I ever saw Josephine on stage. And she gave a speech that really influenced my life, where she talked about going to France, finding freedom, and finding her career and her life. I'm also a dual French and American citizen, so I identified with her on so many levels that it is almost like a mother-daughter relationship. And since this has happened, people have been calling me off the hook. I really feel I am emotionally connected with her.
Compare how Josephine Baker was thought of at the height of her career and how she's seen now. How has her legacy changed over that time?
You know, in the beginning, she was really noted for being an energetic and iconic performer. The Second World War changed her commitments and her image, and there she fought and started to fight strongly for social justice. In 1951, she came to the United States and required that every performance that she give be desegregated. She became known more as a champion of social justice, and she, as a result of that, experienced a number of problems. J. Edgar Hoover revoked her visa to the United States, and she was not able to come back to the United States until 1963, when Robert Kennedy removed that ban and allowed her to return for the March on Washington. This is another reason why she belongs in the French pantheon. As a French citizen, the United States not only turned against her officially for over a decade and a half, her career was made in France.
Are there any iconic songs or performances that come to mind when you think about what a special performer she was?
Of course, Two Loves, Deux Amours, which was her signature song. I Have Two Loves, and over 300,000 copies of that song were sold in the first year. And if you can imagine that back in the 1930s. So that's her, that's the song that, of course, we all associate with Josephine. It became symbolic of her dual connection to the United States and France.
Bonetta Jules Rosette is author of the book Josephine Baker in Art and Life. The French government has decided to exhume and rebury Baker's remains in a place of honor at the Pantheon Mausoleum in Paris. Jules Rosette joined us from San Diego, where she's a professor of sociology at UCSD. Thank you.
Thank you.
We go out today with Josephine Baker singing Two Loves, about her heart being split between America and France. Paris, Paris, tout entier. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. We'll be back with you tomorrow.